Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. The usual two guests today, first and seconds, Russian studies scholar Sean Guillory will talk about Vladimir Putin after his re-election as president of Russia and the West's weird Russia obsessions. And at the bottom of the hour, the sociologist Alex Vitali will explore the reasons behind mass shootings in the U.S. and the right and wrong ways to go about ending them. First, Russia. On March 18th, in one of the least surprising developments in modern history, Russian President Vladimir Putin was re-elected with 77% of the vote on a respectable 68% turnout, up a couple of points from the last election held in 2012. Days later, in a move reminiscent of the Cold War, over 20 countries around the world expelled over 100 Russian diplomats because of the attempted assassination of the former Russian spy turned British agent Sergei Skripal in England. Russia is suspected of having done the deed, but no proof has been offered. Trump, thought to be Putin's puppet by an array of Democrats, was responsible for 60 of those expulsions. Just how popular is Putin, and what's behind all the anti-Russian moves in the West? Sean Guillory is here to explain. He is the host of Sean's Russia Blog podcast, which is sponsored by the University of Pittsburgh Center for Russian and East European Studies. You can find him on Twitter at Sean's Russia Blog. Sean Guillory. First, let's talk a bit about Putin. He won re-election by a strikingly large margin, but you had a piece in Jacobin arguing that we should start thinking about perhaps the beginning of the end of the Putin era. Are these the final days of Vladimir Putin?
You know, it always is hard to say because he has another six-year term, and who knows what's going to happen in those 6 years and what will happen after. But there is a debate coming out of Russia, and it started a few months before the election about what Putin is going to do during this term, because according to the Russian constitution, he can't serve another. So the variety of different opinions coming out of Russia is one option is he's going to find a successor and kind of bring somebody up and start cultivating them and put them forward as the next president of Russia. The other is, and I think this might be more and more likely, at least this is the option most people are pointing to, a reorganization of the constitution and the government to create a position that allows Putin to continue as kind of the father of the country or in some sort of super presidential position where he doesn't necessarily run the country, but he still continues to have a lot of influence, possibly more over foreign policy than anything. So that's the other option. I'd be surprised, and of course, maybe 6 years from now, I'll have to regret this, but I'd be surprised if he continues in the same capacity as president after the six-year term, mostly because, and a lot of people who watch Putin and the Kremlin really closely, he looks incredibly bored. And particularly with domestic politics, he seems to have backing off a lot. His interests seem to be more about foreign policy and Russia in the global sense. It'll be interesting to see exactly how they square all of this stuff in the next couple of years.
Excuse my Russia 101 level questions here, but what exactly is the structure of state power in Russia? Is Putin almighty on his own? Is he surrounded by a cabinet and advisors that have substantial influence on their own? Just how does it all shake out?
The presidency is really powerful, and that's actually an outcome of 1993. You'll probably remember back when Yeltsin fired on the Russian parliament, there was a struggle between the presidency and the Russian parliament. And in that point,
I should say that's an event that most Americans don't remember, even very well-informed ones.
No, not at all. And less so that, you know, at least the Clinton administration backed Yeltsin all the way forward to this basically a coup, if one considers it that way, and you know, bombing the Duma and basically changing the constitution to create this super presidency. And this is what a lot of people forget is that, you know, we wouldn't have Putin in many respects without Yeltsin. And we certainly wouldn't have a strong presidency that Russia has today without Yeltsin. The presidency in Russia has been incredibly strengthened over the last 20 years or so. to the point where now the parliament, and there's lots of debate about this, but the parliament is, it functions as either a rubber stamp for the presidential administration and a lobbying pool for big business and other federal ministries to get laws passed. Around him, there's kind of institutions where one could say this, the presidential administration, which are his kind of handpicked people in various positions. And then there are informal relations, which are people who have close personal ties to him. And this could be big businessmen like the head of Rosneft, the largest oil company, Igor Sechin, or Gennady Timchenko, who is also an old friend of Putin's, who has a lot of, he's one of the richest men in Russia. So Putin is all powerful in terms of governance. But I think the real, his real strength is his ability to balance various factions within the Russian elite and favor some or the others or switch them around.
As I recall, there was something of a St. Petersburg mafia where he came from around him. Is that still the case?
Well, a lot of people around him are people he's known for a long time. And you can see the growth in the really powerful businessmen in Russia come from two places. They're either holdovers from the 1990s. So like, for example, Oleg Deripaska, who has been in the news in the United States because of his connections with Paul Manafort. You know, he's a leftover from the 1990s. And then there are people who became essentially billionaires who are close to Putin personally from the 2000s. And here you would find people like Igor Sechin or Timchenko. Yeah, and a lot of people come from him from when he worked in under Anatoly Sobchak in St. Petersburg, and it kind of came up. He brought with him when he rose up the ranks rather quickly when he arrived in Moscow in 1996. I think it's less so. There seems to be now what Putin is doing in terms of his political appointments and his staff. He's appointing more and more people who are younger, more technocratic, and have loyalty only to him. Which is a standard thing in Russian politics. And this is one of the things, whereas the first couple of terms of Putin's tenure, it's all of these people who came up with him through St. Petersburg. Now you're getting a shift from people who came up only under him. And this would also suggest to a lot of people there's a transitional phase happening in Russia. He's appointing younger governors, he's more technocratic ones, et cetera.
The president appoints governors?
Yes. They abolished elections in 2005 after Beslan, where it was a direct appointment. Now they've reinstituted elections, but the candidates are essentially appointed by the presidency.
And then what is there in the way of a ruling elite that he responds to or answers to?
It's mostly a business elite. Putin came to power in 2000 mostly as a consensus candidate, in the sense of a bunch of powerful sections of Russian politics, the security services, big business came together and basically backed him. And under Putin, you know, the number of billionaires in Russia has grown quite a lot. And so in many respects, he is representative of that business elite and certainly the foreign policy elite.
And how dependent upon the state and the favors of the state is that business elite?
Quite. The richest ones are, because a lot of the big money comes from state contracts and a lot of the big corruption comes from state contracts. So basically, for example, this guy, friend of Putin's, Gennady Timchenko, they want to build a bridge around Crimea. And that project is being given over to Timchenko. And what happens is essentially that they give him a government contract, a lot of skimmed off the top, and then they try to build this thing. You also saw this in Sochi, because essentially one might think of the relationship between Putin and his close circle and the elite more broadly is almost a feudal one. We know you steal, we know you're corrupt, but you can only steal within certain parameters that we adjust every once in a while. And they do this by essentially arresting big names to make a statement. What they do is when the state comes to call upon you, then you have to participate. So with the Sochi Olympics, you know, to have all of these big businessmen to start putting their money forward to build, you know, stadiums and things like this, they essentially have to answer the state's call.
Judging from the election results, Putin is very popular. How popular is he really?
This is constantly mentioned. And of course, the press, both in the West and in Russia, always cite these opinion polls. But honestly, I don't know what popularity for Putin means anymore. In the sense of, yeah, he's popular in the sense of, there's nobody else. I mean, if you watched any even a couple of minutes of the so-called debates during this presidential election, it's either Putin or a bunch of clowns. So the fact that the political pool is so shallow that when you're faced with the question, I mean, who else do you support? There's just nobody else. And the question then becomes, well, how deep is that support? And I always wonder exactly how much of it is Putin by default and how much it would be given a real viable alternative, how that popularity might break down.
But in the early days of his power, I think enjoyed some genuine popularity because he reversed the decline that they experienced in the 90s under Yeltsin.
Right.
What's been happening lately? How well off is the Russian population?
Incomes have stagnated, particularly since the 2008 crash was a big hit, but they slowly recovered from that. Since 2014-ish or so, since the drop in oil prices, incomes have stagnated. You're having far more social and labor protests, though they tend to be quite small. I mean, right now, actually, in Russia, there's an interesting dynamic of local residents protesting against these large landfills, one of which in outside of Moscow sent about 50 people, most of them children, to the hospital of toxic fumes. So you do have a lot more kind of social economic dissatisfaction. The problem is that there are so few political outlets now. The representatives in the legislature don't represent constituents. I mean, they're party list and they don't necessarily come from the regions from where they're elected. And the recourses for politics are just so narrow that all people really have is to go out in the streets. I mean, in this one outside of Moscow, they literally attacked the mayor of the town. So I think this is one of the problems, is that I think there's a lot of dissatisfaction and anger. There's just no real outlet to have that come out. And you especially see it in the last couple of days with this horrible fire in Siberia, where 64 people, again, mostly children, were burned to death. I mean, there's just a lot of anger. And if you look at the press, there's a lot of commentary about how life in Russia is not valued, how corruption is rampant, how the government doesn't do anything about this, particularly local officials. So I think there is a lot of pent-up frustration.
I'm speaking with a Russian studies scholar, Sean Guillory. Now, in the American version of things, Putin is a dictator and the Russian people suffer under his thumb. There's no free expression. It's like Stalin without the hammer and sickle. How much truth is there to that?
To compare it to Stalin is just, I mean, there's no point. It's just not even a conversation. The problem is that, yeah, power is really centralized in the Kremlin and in Putin's hands personally. However, Russia is a very large country. It's a very diverse country and a very complicated one. And the problem, in the way I see it, and this is a historical sense, even under the Soviet period, is that Russia is under-governed. And that means that because power is so centralized in the center, it doesn't have a lot of mechanisms of governance. So what happens is that the way the system is designed, Putin has to take things into his own personal control. So like right now with this fire, one of the things they're saying in the media is that Putin is now personally in control of, let's say, the investigation. And this is not necessarily a sign of his power, but in my opinion, actually a sign of his weakness. Because if he has to personally, in Russian, it's called ruchnoy kontrol, manual control, as the president of the country, if he has to always have his hand on the wheel and the mechanisms of governance don't really work, particularly in the localities, I mean, how much power does he really have? I would say quite little, because the reach of that power is not that far.
Yeah, well, something like that shopping mall fire in the United States, that would be the business of a mayor or a governor and not a president.
Exactly.
It sounds like not only is there a real lack of broad mechanisms of governance, but even the population. How deeply ingrained is the sense of order in the population? I mean, it's just like Americans have so internalized the nature of our political order that, you know, sometimes we can carry on without governmental intervention. Is there anything like that kind of internalization of ideology in Russia?
There is an internalization of the ideology in a sense of a pride of, you know, of patriotism. I think Putin has become somewhat of a stand-in for that, right? He's the representative of the nation. I think there's a lot of deference to his rule and his authority. But Russians, I think, are like a lot of people in the world where their concerns tend to be more about daily life. And daily life in Russia is one of pretty much constant negotiation, right? So the issues of corruption, for example, are more affect daily life in the sense you want to get a driver's license. You know, you have to pay somebody off. You get a traffic ticket, you're going to have to pay somebody off. Though some of these things are getting better, I've heard, with traffic tickets in particular. The rule of law in procedure is always bendable, and there are always ways around it. So in that sense, Russians aren't as internalized as one may think, because in some ways, because of the way the system works, corruption is a way to make things work. It greases the wheels of a heavy bureaucracy in a strange way. So going through daily life and having to circumvent a lot of those rules and procedures that one might associate with, you know, government overbearance.
It must come to as news to a lot of Russians that their country is so mighty and powerful they chose the president of the United States.
Yes. Yeah, that's a running joke, actually, particularly amongst Russian liberals. They find this hilarious.
How are they taking all this incredible demonization coming out of the West?
Well, I can speak to the more kind of educated liberal class, because there's been more chatter about this. I think in the halls of government, they find this quite all hilarious. And they also, I think, feel that they're just being used as a scapegoat. But amongst the liberal minded, you know, in journalism stuff, they're actually quite shocked, some of the indications, because first off, like, for example, there's one journalist named Oleg Kashin who wrote a column a couple of months ago where he talked about how the American media has been held up by Russian journalists as a model. And what all of this Russiagate hysteria stuff has shown them is that actually the American media is in some ways what the Kremlin has always been telling them, which is they only put out what's in the national interests of the government. They have their side, we have their side. And there's been a lot of disillusionment amongst a lot of liberal-minded journalists in Russia who are really quite shocked by how Russians are being portrayed in the United States, so much so that I have people say that, you know, being anti-Russian or xenophobic towards Russians is the last legitimate form of racism.
Well, yeah, that and rednecks. So this is achieving a perfect environment for bigotry among the liberal elite.
Yeah, it's really quite shocking. I mean, I was saying this to my wife last night. It's like, you know, everyone is against xenophobia until it's politically expedient, regardless. So you could be xenophobic towards Russians and have no problem doing that. I mean, I was walking in my neighborhood just a few days ago and saw this bumper sticker on a car saying, "Follow the rubles." If you put that in another ethnic group, immigrant group in the United States, I mean, people would just be justifiably upset about that. But against, you know, Russians, it's apparently okay.
And now we have, it's like the Cold War all over again. We're expelling 60 Russian diplomats. What are they making of all this business?
The Russians have, in terms of the expulsion, they haven't responded yet. It's not just 60 out of the United States, it's 134 total from around the world. So it's quite a big expulsion of Russian diplomats / security service people, right? Because a lot of these people are just working for secret intelligence agencies. And I think this fire is really consuming. In Russia, if you look at the media, there are two kind of main stories. First, the fire in Siberia, and then the expulsion of six, particularly from the United States, of diplomats. And the word coming out of Russia is that they're just, around this Skirball poisoning or attempted murder in Britain, they just feel like they're being used as a scapegoat, even though, in all honesty, I don't know what other country besides Russia would have a motive for trying to kill this guy.
Yeah, what do you make of that?
He's a double agent. He worked for the Foreign Security Services, the GRU, and was spying for the British. And when there was a spy swap, I think in 2008, the British demanded that he was put in prison for spying against Russia. And then the British wanted him, you know, asked for him to be put on the list in this spy swap. And at the time, I think in 2010, there's comments by Putin about these people saying, you know, basically watch your back, like traitors can never be forgiven. And loyalty is a big thing for Putin. I mean, if you look throughout his career, he speaks about it constantly as a really important thing. It wouldn't be surprising or outlandish to think that they would take out a double agent. The big question is why now? And I don't think anyone has come up with a satisfactory answer about that.
Well, when I see things like this assassination, but also all this evidence that's presented of Russian meddling, where I think I'm just required to believe at once that they're incredibly clever at their manipulations, yet so ham-handed that they leave giant calling cards when their work is done.
Right.
What do we make of this?
I think a lot of that is basically how Russians are imagined in the American consciousness in particular as always devious, always conniving, always lying. And on top of all of that, a very centrally controlled country in which the leader, whether it's a Putin or a Stalin or whatever, has the ability to control everyone and everyone is a member of the state. And that's really, I think, an image that developed during the Cold War, where everyone is a potential secret agent of the KGB or, you know, Russians are suspect because they were communists or whatever it may be. And that's unfortunately an image that's lingered. But on the other hand, the other discourse about Russia and the United States, which has a much longer history, and that is one of Russia as kind of barbarous and broken and doesn't function. So it is rather strange to see these two images kind of come together to make a complete mess. So like, for example, take this assassination attempt, the Skripal. One of the potential theories is that, well, this isn't orchestrated by the Russian government. This is a rogue element within the Russian security services, right? Which is certainly a possibility. But the idea that there would be rogue elements is based in the assumption that, well, Russia doesn't really function very well and individuals are able to use power outside of any central control. But on the other hand, when we, you know, in the American press, every time they speak about all these rich Russians are suddenly oligarchs connected to Putin. And most of these guys maybe shook Putin's hand once, but don't have really any real contact with him on a regular basis. Certainly not enough power to lobby him for anything.
And finally, we are just learning that John Bolton has expanded the axis of evil now to include Russia. He wants to make sure that that any reaction by the U.S. to Russian meddling is disproportionate, not proportionate. Yeah. What do you make of this?
I don't know what they could do. I mean, in many respects, the expulsion of these diplomats shows it's more symbolic in the sense of here you finally have European nation. Everybody's kind of have Britain's back, right? This is the symbol of it. But in terms of actually doing something against the Russians, yeah, you could, you know, give them cyber attacks too. Yeah, you can imagine some sort of other operations, but this would only escalate the situation. And I don't understand what the end game is there, because as we all know, you know, they have nuclear weapons too. And this has been something in the Cold War that fortunately kept both the United States and Russia and Western Europe from annihilating one another. So a lot of it I just kind of take as chest thumping and rhetoric. But it also, though, is a symbolic of the problem as to what to do about Russia, because they're not going to go away. If anything, they're going to assert themselves and have been asserting themselves more to get a seat at the table of international geopolitics. And one of the things that concerns me, particularly with this harking back to the Cold War, or that we're in another Cold War, is just a sign that there isn't really a lot of imaginative thinking in terms of how to deal with Russia. And then it also shows the fact that the one thing that would really harm the Russians is go after their money that they're laundering through Western banking institutions and offshore accounts and buying property in the West to launder it. But of course, nobody wants to do that. And just as an example, you know, you have all this expulsion of Russian diplomats, but just today, Germany approved the Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline from Russia through Europe. So we can see where the interests really lie here.
That was the Russian studies scholar Sean Guillory. He hosts the Sean's Russia blog podcast, which is sponsored by the University of Pittsburgh Center for Russian and East European Studies. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break.
I'd like to feed the children. Find a cure for disease. Rebuild cities. And plant a lot of trees. I'd like to help the sick. Build factories. Give money to students. Hospitals and galleries. But I'm afraid of the Russians. I can't sleep at night. So afraid of the Russians. Afraid we've got to fight. I'd like to go to space. Clean up rivers and lakes. Put everyone to work.
That was some of Made for TV's So Afraid of the Russians, a 1983 song produced by John Cale. Next, mass shootings, especially the school kind. Why do they happen, and what can be done about them? And, just as importantly, what shouldn't be done about them? Here's Alex Vitale, who teaches sociology at Brooklyn College, to explore those questions. His latest book is The End of Policing from Verso. Alex Vitale. Let's start with talking a little language. After the Parkland shootings, there were some people on the left who were very quick to want to assign the label terrorist to the shooter. I can understand wanting to have some compensation for the slurs that Muslims have to suffer, where the terrorist equals Muslim and vice versa. There are problems with this expansion of the term terrorist, aren't there?
Many problems. I think that first, when we use the language of terrorism, what we're doing is we're basically giving the state more power over how to respond to these things. And we're framing this as something that can only be addressed through a kind of war on terror mentality. And that's a mentality that's based on one of suppression, punishment, militarization. And we already have a kind of security state, and the way policing is conducted is already increasingly militarized, confrontational, views the population as an enemy. So to start labeling more things terrorism is basically to empower all those mechanisms of state repression. And that diverts us from any kind of conversation about what's really driving these behaviors.
So that's the big question. What is driving these behaviors?
It's important to be as specific as possible about this, because there's a tendency to see a body count and then to label it terrorism, and then that defines it in this incredibly simplistic and anti-intellectual way as just, well, they're the bad guys, they're the enemy, and they need to be arrested, killed, whatever. So different things drive different kinds of school violence, mass shootings, etc. And in fact, I was really impressed by the young people in Washington at the March for Our Lives in trying to talk more intelligently about the fact that not all school violence is the same, and that the school violence that you see in, an economically disadvantaged urban community is still a threat to young people, but it's not the same dynamic as the school violence at Parkland or maybe at Sandy Hook, etc. So are we talking about a young person who's deeply alienated? Maybe there's an underlying mental health issue that has been unaddressed, or are we talking about young people who are insecure in their environment or carrying guns for protection, beefs get out of hand and a shooting breaks out?
The mental health issue is, as the kids say, problematic. On the one hand, you have people saying we shouldn't stigmatize the mentally ill by applying that label. On the other hand, I don't know what you call somebody who goes into a school and shoots 20 or 40 people, other than mentally ill in some sense. But then you have the right, people around Trump, the NRA, like wanting to have more aggressive, almost turning the mental health apparatus into a branch of the police state. So how do we think about this mental health issue?
Yeah, it's a really tough question, and I'm not a mental health expert. I have written, though, a fair amount about mental health policing issues. So I think we need to understand this as a kind of continuum where there are a lot of people who are hurting in their everyday lives and are coping with this in a variety of ways, to people who have quite severe biological brain chemistry problems and respond to specific medications, etc. And so we have to be careful about a one-size-fits-all label, even when we talk about mental illness. There are a lot of young people whose mental health problems are cumulative. They build up over time. And that if there were engagement with them early on in a process, let's say they're trying to deal with trauma in their own lives, maybe at home, maybe they've witnessed violence.
And the Parkland shooter had plenty of that.
Yes, exactly. Maybe they're being bullied. Maybe they're alienated. Also, one of the reasons that schools sometimes feel out of control and we respond with these zero tolerance discipline programs is that we've winnowed down the curriculum in so many schools as part of this kind of privatization, high stakes testing regime. We've gotten rid of drama, we've gotten rid of music, we've gotten rid of art, we've gotten rid of sports even in a lot of places. So kids are bored, so they act out. If we were dealing with those dynamics early on, they wouldn't develop into more serious problems.
It's like we're trying to like make real the cartoonish version of Foucault that has the school as a prison.
We've all often understood schools as like sort of training grounds for dead-end futures in a lot of communities, right? And of course, all schools are not the same. Parkland was a much wealthier school with a much broader range of services and activities, etc. And we talk about a place like Columbine High School. You know, there were armed police at Columbine High School the day of that tragedy, and it made no difference. And right after that, there was a massive increase of spending on metal detectors and other kinds of surveillance systems in poor schools across the country, but Columbine never accepted metal detectors for their upper middle class kids.
The places where these school schootings happen are mostly rural or suburban. They're not impoverished inner city
schools. The mass shootings.
Yeah.
Yes.
Any sense of why that is?
Well, of course, guns tend to be more available in those settings, and especially assault rifles. You just don't have a lot of assault rifles in Chicago or New York City.
Is that because of gun control?
It is in part because of gun control, yep. And also, you know, kids take the school bus to school and walk to school and take public transit to school. You can't really hide an AR-15 in your backpack. But in these suburban settings where everyone's driving, teenagers have cars, they can have a trunk full of ammunition, drive to school, take it out of the trunk, and open fire on people.
What about the relation of these school shootings to the larger issues of American violence? So people are always trying to separate these things out. But, you know, it seems like this country where the police are increasingly militarized and imperial war is just a constant in American life. Does this larger, you know, social organization, how significant is that into understanding these school shootings and doing something about them?
If we look at the issue of kind of the toxic gun culture and the politics that keeps guns available and in circulation, especially assault rifles, but also, you know, most kids at school that are killed by guns are killed by handguns, not assault rifles. Yeah, well, we have to understand that there's a very powerful toxic politics around race that continues to drive this mania about gun ownership, which in my mind is, you know, a direct legacy of being a colonial settler state and using guns to clear the frontier as we move west and using guns to manage enslaved populations and the genocide of the native population. And you hear this kind of language sometimes from the gun culture about the need for protection. And I think a lot of that's driven by these legacies of racialized gun violence. In the contemporary moment, you know, we know that, for instance, the vast majority of guns are owned by actually a very small percentage of gun owners. and they're stockpiling these weapons and they're engaged in these kinds of survivalist fantasies. And you see these, you know, it's interesting the connection between that and the whole zombie ethos in American culture. We got all the zombie movies and zombie TV, and you see these bumper stickers, you know, zombie ready response unit, like people fantasizing that they're going to be this thin line against the zombies. So of course they're saying it with a sense of humor on the one hand, but on the other hand, you see a lot more of these stickers at the gun range than you do in other settings. And I see actually police officers who have these kinds of stickers on their car. So there's a sense of like the barbarians are at the gate and somehow we're going to be this thin line of protection for whatever, some post-apocalyptic imagining. And I think all of this is tied to the deep economic and cultural insecurities that people are feeling across the country. As people's economic lives become more precarious and they see their communities coming apart, there's a kind of sense of which we need these guns to protect us.
It does seem that the gun culture is so deeply embedded with American individualism and self-reliance and a paranoid sense of a war of each against all. It's so deeply embedded in our culture, it's kind of hard to figure out, well, it's hard for a lot of people even to notice it. But then it's hard to figure out, what do you do about that in some practical sense? The whole thing needs to go back to the shop for an overhaul.
Yeah, and for my work, it feeds into this whole thin blue line mentality that we see as a response to like Black Lives Matter, which is that we need to give the police more authority, less accountability, more resources, because they're the only thing holding civilization together. And so that's all predicated on this same ideology that it's a war of all against all, and that the only thing that keeps society coherent is the constant threat of armed intervention. And you just don't feel that same toxic ideology when you're in other industrialized countries. And I've lived in other industrialized countries and spent time working with police and community groups. And it's just not suffused with this idea that everything's about to come unglued. Really, so much of the origin of that is in our history of race relations and white fear of the other.
But you look at other settler immigrant countries like Australia, they don't have this toxic degree of
weaponized fear. But they didn't have slavery, and they succeeded mostly in exterminating their indigenous population, so they're not racially diverse in the same way that the United States is. And to the extent that they have diversity, it's much more recent and it's much more immigration focused. And that does produce resentments in Australia. But I think that this legacy of racialized chattel slavery is really important in understanding the persistence of some of this stuff.
I'm speaking with the sociologist Alex Vitale. Now, we should keep things in perspective. The numbers of people killed in these kinds of mass incidents is only a small portion of the number of people killed by guns in the United States, correct? But what are the...
Yeah, that's the deal. And I think it's important. This is part of the whole drive to have armed police in our schools was driven by the super predator myth and Columbine and then this regime of high stakes testing and zero tolerance discipline. But each of these is like incredibly misguided. And while Columbine was, of course, tragic and terrifying, schools remain the safest place that young people spend time. They are safer at school than they are in their homes, than in their communities, than they are if they work. And so this is very much a kind of media-driven panic that, while horrific, and it's understandable why the media covered it, et cetera, what they fail to do is place it in any kind of context. School shootings remain extremely rare given the number of schools and the number of young people, and the likelihood of a young person being shot is much less likely in their school than in these other settings.
And there's much less attention paid to the routine day-to-day violence in, you know, Chicago and St. Louis than there is to these very dramatic eruptions.
Absolutely. Or what's going on in young people's home lives. You know, we have massive levels of abuse of young people happening across the country, and we have broken child welfare systems that often lead to just further abuse. And until we do something about that, we're going to have these generations of young people who grow up in trauma, and then we're shocked when they act out in violent ways in their lives.
And of course, after every one of these shootings, there's also an eruption of calls for gun control. Details somewhat unspecified very often, but you know, we had this, you know, recent marches across the country, unusually dramatic eruption of the calls for gun control. But what do we mean by that? And given the number of guns we already have out there, what effect would restrictions on sale have?
I'm for it. I would love to see what happened in Australia happen here, where there was basically a wholesale banning and forced buybacks of weapons that was very successful and dramatically reduced the number of guns. But I'm not the least bit optimistic about anything like that. Even if we had a more rational interpretation of the Second Amendment, which is currently interpreted in a totally nuts way, that we would still have massive numbers of guns in circulation. We do have robust numbers of people who use guns for hunting and things like that. I mean, I would be happy to have a situation where the guns have to stay at the hunting club until you go and check them out and use them and then bring them back. But I think the guns in many ways are here to stay. And that's why I've focused so much on the demand side questions rather than just the supply side questions. You know, even if we stopped all manufacture of guns today, there are more guns than people in the United States.
And they last a long time.
And they last a long time, that's right. And so I don't think we're going to see some huge relief in terms of the availability of guns. And there are places that have guns where people don't really shoot each other so often. Canada is a good example where there is a hunting culture and there is gun control, but there are still a lot of guns and people don't shoot each other. If we could address some of these demand side issues, that could provide some relief for us.
And what about the practical question of making schools safer, which is what something everyone wants to do? As you pointed out, schools are not anywhere near as dangerous as we fear they are, but even so, people are going to be afraid that their kid's going to go to school and get killed. What to do about that?
Yeah, well, that's one of the things that concerned me about the March for Our Lives and their demands was, you know, more school resource officers was part of their program.
Does that mean more cops?
More armed police.
That's
in
what
their
resource
officers. Yes. And I think that's a terrible idea. I will say, though, that in terms of the actual program on Saturday, I didn't hear that mentioned. So there may be some stepping away from that, but it was part of their kind of written program. Okay, so how do we deal with this? Most gun violence in schools is perpetrated by students at the school. And so in many, many, many of these cases, we find out that there were young people who had a pretty good idea that something bad was going to happen. In some cases, they actually went to someone and nothing was done. We need to have a situation where young people feel confident that they can go to an adult at the school and express their concerns and that the problem will be dealt with in a fruitful way. What we have now, though, is a situation where if a young person complains to a school resource officer or even assistant principal, it becomes a criminal justice issue. And we've had cases where young people who are scribbling out fantasies of gun violence in their notebooks get charged with terrorism charges. They get arrested, put through the criminal justice system. That's not going to encourage other young people to say something about their friend who's in crisis. Because who wants to be the friend who rats out someone and they end up getting arrested as a result? So we've got to completely rethink the way we handle these kinds of disciplinary issues, threat assessments, etc. It has to be done in an environment that's about solving the problem and trying to restore a young person to some kind of stability and functionality and reducing the threat level. Instead of waiting for the shooter to pull out a weapon, start shooting, and then the school resource officer runs over and shoots them to death, which is what happened the other day. Everyone's cheering this school resource officer for killing the student after he shot two people and saying, oh, how many lives did he save? Well, my guess is that he may not have saved any lives. He may have added to the body count because this young person was only armed with a handgun, seems to have killed the two intended targets, and then is killed by the school resource officer, by the police officer. It's not clear that a lot of lives were saved by handling things that way. My guess is there were probably young people at that school who knew that that kid was angry, upset, and dangerous, and there was no mechanism for doing anything about it. And that's what's got to change.
Yeah, there have been also calls for, I said this earlier, turning psychiatry or social services into a branch of the police force. And like as soon as you hear there's a kid had trouble, drop a dime and call the cops. That seems like a very bad idea.
It's a terrible idea. This is happening across the board. You've got a mental health problem. Well, the cops will decide whether or not you get treatment or jail. You've got a substance abuse problem. Let's let the cops decide whether or not you get treatment or jail. Or let's give it to a drug court to decide. Why are we involving these coercive, punitive criminal justice agencies at all in these issues? If someone has a mental health problem, there should be a mental health infrastructure to help them. And it's going to be much more successful if it's not associated in any way with the criminal justice system. But this is, again, this thin blue line mentality that assumes that the baseline solution to every problem has to be coercive, punitive state force. And until we break the back of that mindset, we're going to continue to get these kinds of crazy suggestions.
So what could be done with, you know, kids who scribble these violent fantasies? I'm sure many kids do scribble violent fantasies as part of being an adolescent.
Right. So if the mindset is not one that's about coercion and punishment, if it's about identifying problems with the goal of trying to like do something about it, then there's not really a big problem if someone says someone should talk to Jimmy because he's been really dark, morose, and has these fantasy scribblings that are incredibly violent. So yes, maybe a counselor who already is known to Jimmy asks Jimmy to stop by the office and say, hey, what's going on? You're not in trouble. We're not going to kick you out of school. We're not going to put you in jail. We just want to know what's going on. Are you, you know, are you just diagramming some fantasy for a new video game, or is something really a problem? And what can we do to help you with that? Is there a problem at school? Are you imagine? You know, we know how to handle situations like that in a non-punitive way. But you know, here in New York, we've got more NYPD personnel than counselors of all varieties in city schools. And this is increasingly the case.
And our schools aren't particularly violent compared to other places, are they?
No.
Finally, every time we have a school shooting like this, I think, oh my God, here we go. We're going to hear the same things on, you know, from all parts of the political spectrum. It's like we go to this step into this routine of eternal recurrence. We have the same, I can't even call it a debate because nobody really engages anyone or changes any minds. Something seems a little different after Parkland. The mobilization of the students has been very impressive, and maybe the conversation is changing somewhat. But is there a way out of this impasse, or does it feel a little different to you now, or where are we going from after this?
Well, it's certainly not going to change overnight, and it's certainly not going to change if we just get like an assault weapons ban. You know, if that's what the movement achieves, that's hardly going to make the kind of difference we need. I think that the question is, are we on the cusp of a kind of new level of youth politicization, youth engagement, and are they going to grow and develop a broader agenda and a broader politics? That's what it's going to take, because there's not really a technical fix to this problem. No one piece of legislation is going to fix this. It's got to be a whole culture shift around how we treat young people. Do we call them gangbangers and hit them with conspiracy charges? Do we call them terrorists and throw them in prison? You know, if these are the tools we have to solve our youth problems, the problems are going to remain and probably get worse.
It's amazing how that discourse of super predators and such
has persisted despite the decline in crime in cities. Like, there's this, like, this level of fantasy now that is almost immune to any kind of rational argument.
Well, ever since DiIulio made his super predator predictions, which were based on totally spurious data, every single year youth crime has dropped in the United States. But the super predator myth serves a political function for the media, for politicians, and so it persists for political reasons, not because it has anything to do with facts or solutions or anything like that. It's a way of defining our youth problems as ones of individual or group moral failure that let the state and markets off the hook as being responsible for any of the problems in society. And that's really at the center of the kind of ideological struggle that we're in, is we've got to quit treating these things as moral questions and start looking at the politics of austerity and market liberalization that is creating so much inequality and precariousness and unaddressed social problems.
That was Alex Vitale, professor of sociology at Brooklyn College and author of The End of Policing from Verso. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of Static Resistance by Hookworms, another great band from Leeds. Till next week, bye.